Welcome to Fireside Chats, Leadership Journeys, brought to you by the Office of Academic Clinical Affairs and hosted by Dr. Carolyn Porta. These chats bring together University of Minnesota Health Sciences students with experts for candid conversation on leadership, career pathways, sources of joy, and strategies to rejuvenate.
Welcome to this Office of Academic Clinical Affairs Fireside Chat. I'm Dr. Carolyn Porta, an Associate Vice President here in the office. I am pleased to be here with you and to have a great conversation with Dr. Roly Duavetti. Dr. Roly Duavetti was recently appointed the Chief Executive Officer of our Cook Clinic, which is a federally qualified health center here in South Minneapolis. I'm delighted to have you, Dr. Roly, and I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself and give us a little bit of your journey of how you came to be where you are today within reason. And then we'll, of course, have some follow-up discussion, conversation, get into a few topics that I think many of us are passionate about.
Thank you. Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks for the opportunity. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Roly Duavetti. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm a family medicine physician by training. Originally, I'm from India, and I came to United States about 22, 23 years ago. Before I go into that, my fun fact is that I never met my husband. I met him on the day that I got married. So that is my fun fact, but he was the reason that I came here. So I came here and then I got a training in family medicine. Before I came here, I just graduated. I actually graduated from the medical school in India, and I was doing a job as a medical director in an underserved area running a charitable clinic. I was given a responsibility to build that clinic. And then I came here and I did a residency in family medicine. And when I was doing that, I rotated at my current location, which is Community University Healthcare Center, and it was very grounding experience for me, serving the diverse patient population or centering my care to the margins and just thinking about how can we promote or improve the care of the people who have so many social determinants of health, and that's where my journey started. So after I graduated, when I was looking for the job, I applied all over, even outside Minnesota as well. But I was trying to find a job which was a combination of like academia and outpatient patient care and research and the training and teaching, all kind of like a mix, hodgepodge of things, which being a family physician, that's what we like just making sure we are on the go. And then every day is bringing passion to our life. So when this job came to me, then I just said yes, because I really love being at Cook. And so I started there and then became a medical director after two or three years, and then chief medical officer, and then most recently was appointed as a CEO. And currently I'm serving as a CEO and CMO both. And another hat that I wear is the vice chair for community engagement for my department, which is Department of Family Medicine and Community Health.
Okay, thank you, Roly. So I'm going to have to stop at fun fact and go back to that. So you effectively met him on the day you got married. I want you to speak a little bit to the guiding principles of relationships, sort of based on that lived experience, and maybe some guiding principles relevant to professional relationships that perhaps you bring to the table, having had that experience.
Yeah, that's a great question. So just being like a genuinely like curious and making sure that we had so I did talk to him but never met him, but having some shared vision and shared goals, and then also making sure that we have a safest space and challenging the processes and empowering and enabling others and particularly him. And then also like grounding in the heart, like what matters for us. Those are the couple of the principles that have been grounding principles for me, for my personal life and also the professional life.
That's great. I enjoy hearing that a bit. And I'm looking at all of the interns as things pop up. Please raise your hand or put a chat in the chat, because really this conversation is for your benefit, for the collective benefit of whoever might listen. But we have the pleasure of the real-time opportunity to sit down and push and press Rolly a bit. Rolly, when you think about yourself as a leader, when did you first identify that way or think about yourself as having that potential?
I think by birth, I was born that way, I want to say. So I'm the only girl in my family. And being born in India as a girl is, at that time, it was difficult for my parents, but they raised me like a strong girl. So I was advocating everywhere, and my dad used to say, oh, now here is Rolly with her flag. So like that's so I just grew up with and was groomed that way, and I just adapted to that habit and learned that. But then when I shifted here, it was challenging just understanding the process, understanding the culture, even language. I never spoke in English before moving here. I read English, but like I never had a conversation in English. So it was when I came here, a couple of years were hard just understanding the medical system, understanding the, I never documented in computers. So just learning everything over. But I think that the way that I was groomed, I think that just kept me pushing and challenging myself. And then, but also like grounding myself, like that I can do it. And it is hard accepting the fact that this is the fact and I have to learn. And those are the things that that kept me pushing. I identified a different type of leadership when I came here, because leadership in academia or in medicine is way different than like you're in a family or when you're in a social situation. So that was like navigating conversations differently, which I learned by talking to my mentors and talking or just seeing or watching how people are like acting or like reading a lot of books or getting trainings, and all that has been helpful in keep me going.
Thanks for that. I want to move into some space around the passionate work you do in terms of structural and social determinants of health. I know there are some questions about health equity as well, and some of your commitment to that. But before that, I want to also level set us. I want to recognize that we all come to this space with characteristics of privilege and characteristics in some ways of disprivilege. So reflect for a minute for yourself around some of the ways in which you experience privilege in society, in academia, in your work environment, and also think about the ways that perhaps you don't experience privilege. And then Rolly, I'm gonna pose that question to you as well. In what ways do you perceive yourself as a person with some privilege? And I'd be curious which elements or characteristics, and where do you see not so much privilege or some of the hurdles that are in front of you?
That's a great question. And thank you for asking that question. And this is a recent learning for me just in a couple of years when I have started acknowledging my privileges. And so I will start with my caste. So I'm originally from India, and we have a caste system, and I belong to the higher caste system in India. And just by being born in that caste gives me a privilege to get the education. Sometimes I feel like if someone in the lower caste might not have access to food, but if I go to the temple, because I have access to the temple, then I'll get the food. So that's my privilege just by being born in the caste and getting access to the education. And because I got the education and now I got the degree of MD, so that's like my acquired privilege. So I gained that privilege. And just having that degree of MD gives me access to different things in terms of the social acceptance or navigating the system or even in academia. So that it's just like a privileges change as a person change, our privileges evolve. In terms of like what could be the other things that like negatively impacting it could be when I came here, my accent was the big thing. So it was like I never spoke in English, so it was hard, and like it was I will be like people will look at me and what. So that was and I just don't know how some of the decision might have been made based on that, which might have impacted my journey where I am right now. Or gender is another thing. So there are several, but a couple of that comes to my mind. I'll just name those.
Thank you. I appreciate that a lot. I'm going to pause right now and ask if anyone else on the conference, on the video conference this evening, wants to share anything in response or reaction to this sense of privilege and where we have it and where we don't, and how that influences who we are, where we are today. There's no right or wrong answers, and you don't have to speak up, but I want to give the opportunity. Please, Bayo.
Right. Thank you. I think, you know, what Dr. Rolly has said, it's again reminds me of the privileges that we have, and we often do not acknowledge it. And what I just want to say mainly is that we all need to make a conscious effort to identify the privileges that we have, and also look at other people who are currently or who might have been in situations where they were not, where they didn't have such privileges, and also try to make a difference wherever we are. I know it's so easy because we just born into it, or we find ourselves in those having those privileges, and it's sort of like a passive thing. And we're just not aware of it unless we make conscious effort to really take it into cognizance. So I just want to implore everybody here to make a difference, that little difference, wherever we are.
Thank you. Thank you for that reflection as well. Anyone else? So Rolly, as you're certainly in a position of privilege and power with the titles you carry, with the credentials you have, what is compelling you to focus on health inequities and social and structural determinants of health?
So it's my patients and my previous lived experiences. It's a combination of both things, how I wanted to make a difference. So the clinic that I work is more than 80% of the patients are the community members that we serve are below the federal poverty line. And when I see that, it reminds me the purpose of going into the medicine and not just the prescribing the pill, but like what actual differences we can do from the system-wide changes or changing the care delivery, putting things in place to actually improve the lives of patients and the community members that we serve. So basically just grounding myself into my patients and the communities that we serve. And when I see the inequities, so when I go to my clinic where I receive care, it's a very different type of care. The experience that I get, and when I go to my clinic, there are so many barriers to care that I strive to provide the same type of experiences to my patients because they deserve it. because we healthcare is a human right, and we need to make sure that everyone has an equitable access. And some people actually even have a better or the more access depending upon where they are on the playing field. So that's what, like, basically grounding myself into my patients and their needs is a main factor for me to keep thinking and keep pushing my brain in system-wide changes to improve the health equities.
I like that. It has me thinking, though. Let me take a step back. So why did you choose this, even these areas to practice? Why not choose a specialty that will give you a lot more income? Why not choose private sector clinical practice? You know, what has motivated or compelled you toward even having this patient caseload?
That goes long back. So my great grandfather was an Ayurvedic medicine doctor. We lived in village, and I watched him, like, doing a lot of care for the people who were underserved. I remember every Thursday he will bring out his desk with his Ayurvedic medicine, because villagers are coming back from the shops, and then he will be providing free care to them. And they were just so, like, happy to receive that type of care. And he was making a difference fast forward. So that was the reason for me to go to medicine. And when I went into medicine, I chose to practice, like, there is an internship that you're required to do. So I chose to practice in the rural India, where people did not have the transportation. So I had to have an effort, because there was, like, no access to care. So I would actually go on a truck with a truck driver to several miles to the rural medicine. And that gives me personal experience of the social determinants of health in terms of the, like, a transportation, access to care, health literacy, you name it. But that was such a great experience for me, just being in the village. And then I saw the impact of the community leaders and the people who do. I remember there were women, so fancy word nowadays is community health worker, but we used to call them Anganwadi worker, and they will be so they will be going from home to home and doing the polio drops or other things, and they were making the actual difference. So, and then after I graduated from the medical school, I again chose to work in a charitable clinic where they were serving a factory worker. So there has been a journey in just, and when you see the difference, I remember when I was in that charitable clinic, a woman came with a baby, like, wrapped in the clothes, and then she just said, like, oh, my baby is just making a funny noise. And we unwrapped the baby, and baby actually was dead, and it was making a squeaking noise, and it was, like, a sudden infant death syndrome, and that was because there was, like, no literacy, no education how to take care of a newborn baby. So that moment, and I decided to stay, that, like, someone has to stay here to make a difference, and I stayed here until I came here. So when I came here, I came to Cook, and then when I saw, like, the patient population, I said, I need to stay here.
Thank you. I love that. I think there are, all of us probably have some lived experiences in our personal lives, as you've shared, and then also in our volunteer life or work life, that does compel us towards certain areas. Very early on in my career, I knew that I wanted to be in prevention side instead of figuring out how to fix the problem after the fact. And yet I also ended up as a forensic nurse caring for recently sexually assaulted patients. And so I have the passion for prevention, and I also have now this passion for response that's very trauma-informed and patient-centered, and giving of power back when someone has just gone through one of the worst experiences of their lives. And I think everyone listening and all of you engaging tonight, for yourself, you know some of those drivers that are pushing you to be in the field you want to be in and pushing you in the workspace that you want to be in. And you're here in the internship program in part because you want to gain more skills as leaders. I'm not going to even say potential, but as the leaders that you are and that you are becoming. And you have the opportunity, I think, to also work work in teams, hopefully for some common good for community-based organizations, for COOC, and for some clinical partners that I think also are trying to mitigate social and structural barriers and inequities. I'll pause if there's anyone that wants to speak up or share. There are a couple of questions, Rolly, that get at advocacy and the tools that you need to drive change, to challenge the inequities. And I wonder if you have any sort of initial reflections or thoughts around the biggest tools in your toolkit when you think about the work to not just deliver day-to-day individual patient care, but also to influence the macro society when we think about the entire ecosystem influencing health and well-being. You know, what are your favorite tools?
So first is definitely modeling the way. So I think that is super important for me. And then from my work that I do is keeping a very close eye on like looking at the things from the justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion lens, which is from my clinical work. So when I'm developing a policy or a protocol, looking at it from that perspective in light of which patient population that I'm serving. And that helps me in like grounding myself and centering myself in making a decision which are like Jedi centered. And then making sure that I'm not only locally, a lot of these things happen at a state level or the federal level. So keeping an eye on at the systemic level, like how the policies are happening or getting changed, or like what policies to move forward or to support. Those are one and like a couple of like important things that I keep an eye on, like always. And then internally at the micro level, I think it is all about empowering people, making sure that we have shared value and the shared vision. And as I said, encouraging the heart and buy in. And I personally strongly believe that we all are learners. And how can we have a mutual learning environment? I always say I'm always learning from my nurse who's assisting me, because they know more than me. I might be just making a cut or prescribing a pill, but it's just and that's where I think the interprofessional empowerment comes. Like, how do we lean on or operate on teams or do solo work, but leveraging. And that is one important tool. A lot of people ask me, oh my gosh, you see a lot of patients, you're a CEO, but you're also still seeing patients. How come? And when you're seeing patients, you're super busy. And I see it is because I am making sure that I'm working really well with my team. So the person that I'm working with, they know, they basically I empower them to run my show. So they will help me in making sure that the patient is getting supported, they're getting better experiences, and people are working at their fullest scope of practice as well.
So of all those things you listed, if you had to pick one favorite tool, your most versatile perhaps, or your forced to choose one, which would it be?
Generous listening.
I love that. Say more about what you mean when you say that, or share an example where it's made a difference.
So generous listening is a tool which can help handy. If you are a physician, if you're not a physician, if you're a physical therapist, or if you're a psychologist, or if you are a general human being, or putting an admin hat, it's just a lot of time we are so responsive rather than being reflective, and we don't give enough time in conversation to ourselves and to the person who's sitting in front of us in just processing the information that is being transferred from one person to another person. And we are in, our mind is just running so fast. Oh, this person is saying this, I should be responding rather than just like a listening. And that just brings such a meaningful outcomes. If we just pause and just listen, and it creates a lot of opportunities as well.
I agree. Now I'm going to pause and reflect and reflex before I raise the next question that has to be somewhat linked to what you just shared. No, I agree 100%, 100% on what you shared. I think that it links also nicely to the set of questions around community engagement and community buy-in. So there's reflective, reflexive listening that's very powerful at the individual patient care level, which many, many people listening, that's what their primary role will be for many years. I imagine that skill is also critical when you're thinking about your community engagement and your collective community buy-in. I wonder if you have a few examples of applying that skill in that space and some recent wins or disappointments that you've had to overcome when it comes to community engagement.
Yeah, for sure. I can give a couple of examples. So first of all, that I chose and I'm privileged to work at the FQHC, which is governed by patient and the community board. So a lot of buy-in happens because we are governed and a lot of policies are governed by the patient. So we are grounded in, again, in patient care and what matters to them. So I really generously listened to them. I had a board meeting last night and we presented a lot of information to them. And my board chair, I had a meeting with her this morning. And the one information that was presented was like how many incidents or the codes happen in the clinic in calendar year 2022. And we were reflecting on that and we figured out, well, we need to present this information. So I heard what she was saying is that a lot of people might not know what the code is. So how do we present the information, break it down to the people or at the community level that we are serving so that they can understand what the information is? So I will be working on creating another document so that it is the language that is being used in presenting the information. It is in the most digestible format. So that's one example, and I can give more, but like that's at the board level. The second is that we do, I have a lot of connection with community leaders. So they have my cell phone. They call me, they talk to me if like what is going on. So a couple of examples is when we responded to when community members from Afghanistan started coming to the Minnesota and started locating here. We were the one who started responding to them, and we said, well, we will create a care delivery because there is a need. So we asked someone to connect someone with a community leader. We started going to the airport, started welcoming them, and then just being there helped us in understanding like what their needs are. So like not just assuming like what is needed, but engaging the community members in understanding what is needed. Another example that I can give that was at the height of the COVID was that COVID cases were so high and the vaccine just came, and I got a call from we were planning a COVID vaccine event, but I got a call from Sheikh. The Sheikh is the religious leader who does ceremonies in the mosque. But I got a call from the Sheikh and he said, Roli, I'm heading to I need to head to the airport, but I wanted to talk to you because the Ramadan is coming and there will be a lot of people out in the community without masks because they will be praying. What can you do to immunize these people? Can you bring a team here? And I said, okay, well, that's what we have to do. So we needed to internally figure out what do we do internally? How do we figure out the resources so that I can answer and address the community need? So another thing is that right now we are responding to Ecuadorian families who are coming and settling. So we have we go and bring our like a mobile health team. They go and talk to them, assess their needs through the community health worker, and connect them to the primary care. So I think basically, again, I will go back to my original is it is about just extending our hand, putting our feet to their side of the story, just becoming a part of the community, understanding, listening what is needed, and engaging them in that way, and empowering how another example I wanted to give, I'm just finishing a research project, and it just got done. And when it came to presenting the finding, I'm going to a national conference, and I just said, nope, I need to bring these community leaders who did the project for me, who did the focus group. So I'm bringing two people with me, and we'll figure out the finances or whatever, however it happens. But like, they are the ones, so they are coming with me. So it takes an effort to think about, especially in academia, how do we engage community, empower them, and not, a lot of time community feels that they're getting, like we're using them. And getting their skills or getting the feedback from them, and then the separate, but like, how do you become a, because sometimes we like community is out there, but we are part of the community.
Those are great examples. Years ago, I was partnered on some projects with St. Paul Public Schools, working with Latino partners, and the director of the program, his name is Pablo Matamoros. He and I worked very closely, and we spent a lot of time just getting to know each other and our teams and building the relationship and the trust well before the project started. Well, a month or so ago, I was asked to come and give a talk about community-engaged research, and your example reminds me, I did the exact same thing. I said, even if you're giving me only 3 minutes to talk, it's not right if I don't bring my community partner. And Pablo and I haven't talked for years, but that was the example I wanted to share. And we reconnected by email, and he's going to come, and we're going to share the 3 minutes. But that's the way you live out the values. You don't just say you want to do community-based participatory research or community-engaged work. You live it. And, you know, it's birthed in relationship and trust. And it's effective and authentic, and it will last years. If you just do it to just do a project, it won't last, and it won't have the impact that Rolly's talking about, where the community is now engaging her for support and help. She's not needing to knock on the doors always.
And it's hard work. I just want to say, like when we started responding to the people who are coming from Afghanistan, It was hard work. Whenever a new community moves in, you have to basically start from scratch in teaching and education how the healthcare system works. So there were incidences where people showed up demanding to be seen, and there's like no appointment available. So how do we shift and how do we do things and still see the patient and take a moment to educate how the system works? So it was a very meaningful experience, but it's hard work, and resiliency is super important when community engagement work is done.
Thank you, Rolly. And that's a nice transition into my last two questions, really. When you speak of resilience, it leads me into self-care and how you rejuvenate yourself and how you take care of yourself. I think it's easy to listen to ideas and top 10 lists of how to do this. For you yourself, those who are listening, you know the things that bring you health and healing and peace and joy. And you need to really hone in on those and protect those. The next few decades ahead of you are not going to be easier. They're going to be just as challenging as the academic preparation journey is. And I'm just really advocating for you to figure out what it is for you that you need and stick with it. And Rolly, I'll ask you that question. You know, what do you need? What are your go-to self-care strategies?
Several, otherwise I will not survive. So I try to accept when I'm on call. I try, and so I work really hard, have a long days. I leave home at 7 and I come home at 7:15. But after that, then I switch off. And then that's me time. So then I cook every day. I take a walk every day, and I make sure that I'm watching some Bollywood TV every day. So that's my me time. And I have a dog. So then I like to walk the dog as well, or play with the dog. I love gardening. I love reading. I run a volunteer group for the South Asian Women's Mental Health Group. And that's like really nice thing for me to be engaged in doing some volunteer work. So like a lot of several things.
Thank you. I resonate with a lot of those, like a lot. I'll have to get your top Bollywood show list. Perhaps that comes up now in the question about podcasts and books or music or shows. What are some of the top things crossing your mind and your desk and your screen these days that the listeners might want to check out?
So I finished a book a few weeks ago called Power of Women. It's written by Dennis Mukwege, who's a Nobel Prize winner, as a physician. Awesome book, like really great book. It's based on Congo. And then right now I'm reading Covenants of Water by Abraham Verghese. It's really, really very well-written book. His internal medicine doc at Stanford, but very, very nice book. And as far as the show, I'm watching, this is my fourth season, New Amsterdam. That's a really great show. I was giving the example actually this morning in a meeting where we were talking about the patient satisfaction. And last night, he's a medical director in this show in a New York hospital. And he, when he saw very high patient satisfaction rate, he was not happy. So like, there is something wrong if you have a really high patient satisfaction. So he changed all the question and the rate dropped, and he was super happy because he saw opportunities to make improvement. But it's a really fun show to watch.
I love that. Thank you. And thank you for taking time with us, taking time not beyond your 7:15, but still, you know, still thank you. I know you have a lot of responsibilities, and you know, we get the benefit of learning from some of your life experiences and your lived experiences professionally and personally. Thank you for a level of vulnerability. We don't always get that. And you really just kind of jumped in, you dove in without hesitancy to share. And I'm really grateful for that.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to have the invitation and share my thoughts. And I also wanted to say, like, Zoom can be really, really awkward in terms of asking questions, but now you know who I am. You can find me at the university website, and you can send me an email if you wanted to connect in person or just want to go out for a coffee or a chat further, and like, I will be available.
Thank you, Rolly. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Let us know what you gained from this conversation by writing a quick review. Please share this podcast with others, subscribe for future conversations, and check out our other episodes. Explore health sciences at the University of Minnesota at health.umn.edu.